Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 20. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
I miss the days when I could carry my kids in from the car at night. You know those days, right, where you pull up and it's just late and they sometimes even faking, right, that they're asleep just so you carry them, where it's like, well, that's perfect, I'll carry you. But sometimes that carrying, as I brought them in, it wasn't always as smooth as I wanted it to be. My daughter, who's 23 now, this is a couple decades ago, she never really liked bedtime or anything that hinted of bedtime, and so she would often become more and more unrestful as she saw bed approaching. And so this was one of those nights where I picked her up and I was carrying her in and she just wasn't moving towards rest at all. In fact, she was just seemed more and more anxious. So finally I was like, hey, whoa, 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 whoa. That didn't work too often, but whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's just get into calm mode. I use that phrase. That was like one of the key words, right? Calm mode. We're all going to get calm now. We're getting out of this hyper mode and moving into calm mode. She actually got a little bit quiet. And then after a while, she asked, what's a commode? I was puzzled. And finally, I told her, wait, I never said commode. Maybe that's why it wasn't working. Commode. Jesus actually starts out this text by announcing what he didn't say and is not saying. And he says it emphatically. He begins in Matthew 5, verse 17. We read 17 through 20, and he starts right there in 17 and says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law. And then he repeats it. I have not come to abolish the law. And he says, but to fulfill it. There's actually a few different ways to say but in the Greek. And he picks the one that emphasizes the biggest contrast. So I have not come, don't think I've come to abolish the law. I have not, repetition, but in contrast to abolishing it, I fulfill it. Well, that's actually interesting, right? That can leave us with some questions. One, what does it mean to fulfill the law? In what way did Jesus fulfill the law? If you've been here the last couple weeks, Travis has been preaching on the Sermon on the Mount. We're still in the Sermon on the Mount. And he actually highlighted it. He said, isn't it interesting as we see Jesus, right? Jesus has come out of Egypt, right? It says in Matthew 2, verse 15, that his parents had to flee with him to Egypt. And when he came out of Egypt, what Matthew tells us is this fulfills the prophecy, that out of Egypt I will call my son. That what we saw in the Old Testament was Israel coming out of Egypt through the waters of the Red Sea, through the wilderness for 40 years. Right? And while they're moving through the wilderness, they come to a mountain. Moses goes up on the mountain and receives the law. What we have seen so far in Matthew is Jesus has come out of Egypt. He has moved through the waters of baptism. He has moved into the wilderness or the desert to be tempted for not 40 years, but 40 days. And he comes out of the desert and goes up on top of the mountain with the people around him now on the mountain. And he begins to discuss his relationship with the law. That in this fulfillment, for sure, an aspect of that fulfillment is Jesus is saying that everything that happened in the Old Testament, all the law and the prophets, they're all pointing to me. It's like the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, Testament and Covenant, same word, interchangeable, all pointing to Jesus. The Old Testament is the sign, and Jesus is what the sign is pointing to. It doesn't just stop at chapter 5. By chapter 11, Jesus, in front of the crowds, is saying, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Rest. What do they accuse Jesus of in the very next chapter, Matthew 12? Breaking the Sabbath. Breaking the Sabbath rest. Jesus hears their accusations and says, "Don't you know? I am Lord of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is and was a sign pointing to me. I'm the fulfillment of the Sabbath. I'm the one who brings rest." They ask later on in chapter 12, "Give us a sign. Give us a sign that you are who you say you are, that you have this authority." And he says in Matthew 12, verses 40 and 41, "I'll give you a sign. I'll give you the sign of Jonah. That even as Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the belly of the earth for 3 days and three nights." Jonah, a prophet for sure, used to bring about repentance in Assyria, for sure, in Nineveh. But what is his highest purpose? He's a sign. And he points to Jesus. If you're on your way to the Grand Canyon, and maybe a mile before you get there, you see a sign that says Grand Canyon this way. Maybe it even has a picture, maybe a beautiful picture on it. It says Grand Canyon this way. So you go down the street another mile, and you get before the Grand Canyon, and as beautiful as the sign may have been, it cannot match the beauty, the awesomeness, is that a word? Of the Grand Canyon. That what the sign is pointing to is greater than the sign. That Jesus stands on the other side, and now on the other side of resurrection, where we can say Jonah was a sign and he did give us the sign of Jonah. And Jesus is what the sign was pointing towards, and he is greater. That Jesus did not abolish the law, but fulfilled it. If you got to the Grand Canyon, you don't go back now and burn the sign. It's still of value. In what sense? People who look at it will be pointed to Jesus. He doesn't abolish the law. He fulfills it. So what are the consequences of this? Because there are some consequences. If we read on just in the short text we read today, right, Matthew 5, 17 to 20, by the time we get to verse 20, we see some clear consequences. The consequences of not abolishing the law are at least include this. If Jesus did not abolish the law, then the kingdom is impossible to enter alone. And that's where he lands on verse 20. And he says, look, I'm telling you that if your righteousness doesn't exceed, even greatly exceed, the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, then you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, in the Greek, there are multiple ways to say no or not happening. There is the one that is most emphatic, and Jesus uses it. He is saying, you will no, not ever enter the kingdom if you try to go about it the way of the scribes and the Pharisees. And it becomes most clear, or I should say, just even more clear than in this text, what exactly the scribes and the Pharisees are doing by the time we get to chapter 9. Because in Matthew chapter 9, Jesus is hanging out with tax collectors and prostitutes, the sinners of the day. And the scribes and the Pharisees, they object. And they say to the disciples, why is your master, why is Jesus hanging out with sinners? Jesus' response, I'm a doctor, and I've come for the sick. That I've come for all of those who know that they are unhealthy, and I've come to make them whole, to make them healthy, to make them well. That the scribes and the Pharisees thought that by their doing, they were proving that they were healthy enough, that they were ready to move into the kingdom without Jesus. And Jesus assures us, impossible. And over the years, my hips, actually plural, have begun to hurt more and more. That what I find is like, I absolutely cannot do the things I used to take for granted. I mean, like running or jumping, I cannot do them. It hurts too much. But what I actually thought was, it's not that bad. I can't run and jump, but I can walk. I can walk, so that's what I do now. Like I used to play sports, now I go for walks. All right. Here's where I knew it just had gone too far. I had to go to the doctor. On the bad days, I couldn't walk. So I was like, what is going on here? I cannot even walk today. This is even worse. I'll go with a walk with my wife and I have to say, slow down. Absolutely unacceptable. Time to go see a doctor. So I did. By the way, in this community, I consider the need to replace my hips, which is where I am, kind of like street cred. You know, this is Williamsburg's retirement community. I want you to know, in between services, I got like 4 recommendations for who can do a hip replacement. So it's okay. Hey, we're all in this together, right? But I find that I can do the same thing in my spiritual life. And I've actually found that it's just pretty human, that it's easy to do. That we can be dealing with things like guilt. And I'm not talking about that guilt that sometimes we feel for things we're not responsible for. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about guilt for things that we are responsible for. We've got this weight, and it just hangs on us, and maybe it's been hanging on us for years. But you know, we don't feel it all the time. So maybe we have good days where we forgot about it and we can go off and tell ourselves we don't need a doctor. But on those bad days, we know that this guilt, it's keeping me trapped in the past. This guilt is preventing me from moving forward with any sort of confidence to do anything significant. This guilt is enslaving me. It's trapping me. And it's not just guilt. Sometimes we might not be feeling guilty. We just look at our lives and we look at some of the decisions we've made and kind of some of the repeated bad decisions. And we know we need a doctor. But since we don't feel this necessarily every day, we can keep going on without looking to the doctor, without asking to get well. That maybe we have broken relationships, and we know we have a hand in these relationships. Maybe we're not 100% responsible, but we've got some responsibility in it. It's easy to tell ourselves, I have so many other relationships that are in place. I'm okay. I don't need a doctor. We actually can do exactly what the scribes and the Pharisees did. We can just kind of zero in on what we're doing okay with and convince ourselves we don't need a doctor, that somehow we're going to be healthy without him, that somehow we're going to enter into his kingdom without him. And Jesus assures us, we can't. It's impossible. So where's the good news? Well, the good news is the doctor is the one speaking. That Jesus makes the impossible kingdom possible. Jesus makes the impossible kingdom possible. And he actually does it without removing us from a relationship with the law. It's interesting, right? Almost surprising. That in what we read in verse 18 is, look, not an iota, not a dot, not a jot, not a tittle, whatever translation you got out there, not even one little thing will be lost from the law until heaven and earth pass away. That until the new heaven, the new earth, resurrection day, that whole time, nothing about the law will pass away. And then in verse 19, our relationship to the law, do not think that we don't have to do, that is, obey and teach the law. Don't let even the littlest thing fall away from the law, or you will be least in the kingdom of heaven. And in contrast, if you want to be great, well, then do and teach the law. How can that be? I think it can be because verses 18 and 19 come after 17. That what is made clear in verse 17 is that law is Jesus. And so now what Jesus is saying is absolutely, you can't get in with me. But here's how you get in. You get in obedience to me. Follow me. Come to me. That what Jesus does in Matthew 5, verses 17 through 20, is he dispels two pitfalls. The first one is legalism. This idea that if you do enough good, you'll get in. That you will be legal, you'll be allowed in. He gets rid of that. No legalism. But here's the other thing. And no lazyism. Now, I want you to know that in between services, we debated how to spell lazyism. And we found that there's no wrong answer. We just made the word up. So spell it any way you want. I like the hyphen in between the Y and the I, but we'll go with that one. No legalism, no lazyism. All right. I'm 50. So I am equidistant. I haven't used that word since, like, college. Okay, I'm equidistant from the 75-year-olds and the 25-year-olds. I'm 50. Okay, what message do you mostly hear out of these two? Like, what do you hear most from the 75-year-olds? No legalism. Why? Well, because in general, that generation grew up in a culture where it was like, you go to church and you're fine. Don't worry about following Jesus, just go to church. Carry around your Bible, you're fine. There was plenty of legalism. So when that generation reads 5, 17 through 20, that's typically where their mind goes. That's great. Jesus went there too. But what do you think you have to teach the 25-year-olds? And I would even say the 50-year-olds. I grew up hearing, don't be a legalist. So you know what I did? I decided I was a Christian, and it had no claim on my life at all. I did nothing. So I went through high school saying I was a Christian, doing exactly what I wanted to do, with great confidence. And college. It's not like I haven't made any mistakes since then, but that was a stretch where it was very clear. I really wish someone had come along and said, I have no idea what you are. Here's what you are. You're confusing. Because in Matthew 5, 17 through 20, Jesus doesn't leave room for either of these. It's impossible to enter the kingdom if I think I can legally get there on my own, or if I think it doesn't matter what I do, so I'll do whatever I want. Neither of these are allowed. It's Jesus who makes the impossible kingdom possible. So what happens is Jesus makes it possible to enter his kingdom. How? Because he tells us that in this midst, this turmoil of guilt and failure and broken relationships, he says, I am the doctor, and I can make you well. That's Matthew 9, verse 12. As soon as we get there, we are right back where we want to be, and at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. How does Jesus start? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Theirs is the kingdom. When I get to this place, when any of us get to the place of, I need a doctor, I'm tired of going into denial, pretending I don't, I need a doctor, Jesus, I'm with you. That's poor in spirit. And at that point, Jesus says, you're in. This is who the kingdom is made up of. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus makes it possible to enter his kingdom. But there isn't one beatitude, right? He goes on. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. I can tell you, when I've been on the run, there's one thing that doesn't exist: mourning. I don't even want to think about it, or I want to justify it. Those are the only two things I'm doing. Jesus says, no, that's actually not the sequence. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. What am I mourning? I'm mourning the things that I've done. I'm mourning as I look around and see a broken world and know that I'm a part of this broken world. that when I come poor in spirit, mourning is there too. It doesn't end there, right? I'm not just stuck in this agony. He comforts us. Beatitude number three. It's my favorite one, I think. Can you have a favorite? I mean, they're all good. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. That this peace changed my life. That the promise is that if we'll come to him poor in spirit, Lord, I need a doctor. Jesus, I believe you are who you say you are. I see you fulfilled that sign of Jonah. It was all pointing to you. I need you. Change me. I see what I've done. It breaks my heart. Change me. He says, I will. And here's how I'll do it. When you look to me in meekness, I will move you forward. That he, Jesus, makes it possible to enter his kingdom. And I would just encourage you. It was only a couple weeks ago, Travis asked you to kind of post these Beatitudes somewhere. Let's say do that and maybe even memorize the first three. Because this is a process that we as believers, we go through it moment by moment every day. Am I going to live in his kingdom in this moment? Sometimes we get crushed worrying about, well, what are you saying? Like, who can do that forever? Jesus says, don't worry about tomorrow. Just today. Just now. In this moment, do you hunger and thirst for me? Will you come to me poor in spirit, mourning, know my forgiveness, and move forward in meekness? And if we'll do that, I think we'll find this next point true as well. That Jesus makes it possible to enter his kingdom, but he doesn't leave it there. It's not like he just heals the hips and says, now stand still. Jesus makes it possible to move forward his kingdom. This is what he does. How else can we explain Matthew 28, those last three verses of the whole book? Go and make disciples. Go. Move my kingdom forward. Baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. In teaching them to do what? The Old Testament? The commands of Moses? No. Everything that I have commanded you. Go move my kingdom forward. I recently read a story of a woman. She was invited over to a friend's house. She knew there was going to be some people there, but she wasn't quite sure what it was going to look like. When she got to the door, she realized that it was a loud party, and it was a crowded party. So kind of hot and muggy, just not her thing. So she said, I debated, like, should I even be here? But she and her husband entered in. When they got in there, they could hear one of the local worship bands leading music, and they had pushed the furniture aside so that the sound equipment could be there, and people could be standing in front of the band and worshiping, and she's pretty uncomfortable with this whole scene. It's just not her scene. She said, then I saw her. She said, I saw a woman standing in front of that worship team, and her eyes were closed, and her hands were raised, and her body was swaying, and she's worshiping. And she said, that thought that came into my head is, well, for whose benefit is that? Like, isn't she making a scene? She criticized her. Just boom, came rushing in. You ever have criticisms come rushing into your head? She said, at that point, I knew I needed to pause. Because I have a habit of rushing into criticism. So she said, at that point, I paused in an attempt to overcome the criticism, the critical voice that was coming into my head, I prayed. It's like, just replace the thought, right? began to pray. I began to pray for the woman, she said. As she's praying, she said, another thought comes into her head, and the thought was this: you don't know what she's been through. Dick Woodward used to tell me, every voice you hear, it's one of two voices, right? It's either the enemy or it's the Lord, right? And so when you hear a voice that leads to mercy, you know that's the Lord. Enemy's never moving us towards mercy. You don't know what she's been through. She said, I continued to pray, and as I prayed, she said, this other thought came to my mind that she kind of reminds me of Mary. You know Mary, who came in and made the scene in worshiping Jesus by pouring the ointment all over his feet, and people began criticizing her? It came to this woman's head that the woman's like Mary. She couldn't get her out of her mind the whole party. By the end of the party, she felt God nudging her to go tell her. Go tell her that she reminds you of Mary. And the woman said, wouldn't that be encouraging her behavior? Oh, man, right? Criticism, boom, right back in there. So she dismisses that thought. It's actually my job, like what I'm being told to do. So go tell her. You remind me of Mary. So she went and told her, you remind me of Mary. And when the woman heard that, she looked away. And then she looked back and made eye contact and said, you don't know what I've been through. Oh, the woman telling the story said, I got chills. And the woman went on to say, recently I've lost my husband and my son. And worship is the only joy I can ever find. It's the only place I find joy right now. What this woman's story displays is how Jesus makes it possible for us to move his kingdom forward, how we move forward his kingdom. That this woman, she heard the criticism come into her head, but then she knows, like, it's not from God. That's how I am, but that's not from God. So in poorness of spirit, she turns and looks to Jesus. She has mourned this sin. That's why she knows that it's her habit in the past. I'm sure she's done damage with it in the past. And it could be like this with any sin. She just began to know, I have a tendency to sin like this. And then in meekness, she turns to the Lord in prayer. And Jesus gives her the words to say. This is right out of Matthew 10. Jesus warns them, look, when you go tell people about Jesus, don't tell the people about me. They're going to drag you to courts in front of governors. It's going to be scary, except I'm with you. I'm with you to the end of the age. And don't worry about what you're going to say. My spirit will give you the words to say. That whether it's in our own personal lives, just all by ourselves, that we do these three beatitudes over and over and we avoid legalism and lazyism, that we find that we are just connected with Jesus, who's doing a moment-by-moment miracle in us, that Jesus is making the impossible kingdom possible, that Jesus is making it possible for us to enter into his kingdom. And if we will come poor in spirit, desperate and hungry for righteousness, mourning our past sins, and if we find we have one to mourn now, we mourn it now. Approaching him in meekness, Jesus makes it possible to move forward his kingdom.